Chapter 9. Early on Wednesday, the east wind, which had been dying all night, at last expired in a peaceful calm. No more whirling dust, no more banging shutters, falling tiles. A blessed quietness. By the time the sun had risen 10 degrees or so, the sea breeze began to waft in, and by mid-morning it was blowing a moderate gale from the southwest. The surprise could have carried full topsails, but Tom Pullings, less given to cracking on than his captain, would have had a reef in them. It blew steadily all that day and the next, and on Friday Tom pulled over to San Lorenzo once more, walked across the island, and so up to a point below the beacon from which he commanded an immense stretch of ocean, bounded by a hard, unusually distinct horizon. He swept this clear line with his glass, and there indeed, due west, was what he had been looking for yesterday afternoon and evening, slowly drinking cold tea as he did so, a remote fleck of white in the sun between sea and sky. He climbed up to the beacon itself, sitting where a rockfall gave him a firm rest for the telescope, and focused with the utmost care. At this height she was already topsails up, with another ship behind her, and well before likelihood became certainty his heart was eased, filled with happiness. She was surely the Franklin, and she was bringing in a prize. Presently, when the sun was hot on the back of his head, she was hull up, and he was wholly satisfied, head and heart. He had commanded her, and now he could not be mistaken. He might go back to the surprise with an easy mind and sit in peace, admiring her new rigging, all fresh rove and set up, all blacked where blacking was called for, yards likewise. And he could tell Father Panda. For days now Tom had been growing more and more worried, with the doctor away and the Reverend coming every night for news of the captain, clearly anxious, clearly aware that something ugly was up, bringing the sick back, advising him to close with the men bargaining for the prizes, to get the barkie out of the yard, watered, victualled and ready to weigh, all shore leave stopped. And certainly there was something very odd about the town, with people running about and behaving strange. Some who had always been civil and more than civil had grown rather shy. The master of the rope walk, for example, all smiles and a glass of vino on Sunday, reserved if not downright chuff on Monday. The ship chandlers and the dockyard people had become very eager for their money. On the other hand, three considerable merchants had come to see him after dark, most visiting took place by night at present, and had asked him to carry treasure down to Valparaiso. Mr. Adams, who spoke Spanish almost as well as the doctor and who managed all business affairs, said that when the Viceroy came back there would be a fine old rumpus, all hell to pay, with people copying it right and left. Quite why he could not tell, there being so many different rumours, but it seemed that the soldiers had been misbehaving, and perhaps some civilians too. He reached his boat, the doctor's skiff, newly painted green, shoved off and made his way through some small craft setting lobster pots. He had noticed a good many a mile or so offshore fishing in their primitive way, slab-sided objects and some of them mere dug-out canoes. There was not a seaman among them, and at no time did he pay any attention to their more or less facetious cries of "Speak English! Yes, yes! Marano! Heretico pallido!" One particularly obstinate bugger a good way off in a disgraceful, battered old thing almost the size of a man-of-war's longboat, but only pulling three lackadaisical oars, kept barking like a comic sea lion, on and on, anything for a laugh. Pullings frowned and rowed a little faster, his head turned from the distant boat, a craft of no known form with bits and pieces dangling over the gunwale. He was, after all, a commander, R.N., by courtesy called captain, and he was not to be barked at by a parcel of seals. As his pace increased, so the sea lions began to bawl out altogether. A pitiful exhibition, and much too hoarse to be amusing. But as the sudden clamour died away, a single disgusted voice, not very loud, came clear across the quiet water.
"Oh, the fucking sod!"
That was no native cry, no heathen mockery. That was a naval expression familiar to him from childhood, and uttered in a naval voice. He turned, and with a mixture of horror and delight, he saw the massive form of his captain heaving up for a final hail, clinging to the stump of a mast, and he recognised the shattered hull of the Alastor's launch. Having whipped the skiff round and come alongside, he wasted no time in asking what had happened, or telling them they looked terrible, but gave them his bottle of cold tea. They were almost speechless from thirst, lips black, faces inhuman, passed a line and began towing the launch towards the shore. It rowed with prodigious force, rising on the stretcher and pulling so that the sculls creaked and bent under his hands. He had never seen the captain look more destroyed, not even after the Alastor action. The bloody bandage over his eye had something to do with it, but quite apart from that, his bearded face was thin and drawn, barely recognizable, and he moved with difficulty like an old man heaving slowly on his oar. From the skiff, Pullings looked straight into the launch. The captain, Darkie Johnson, and Bondon were doing what they could, labouring with uneven sweeps, roughly shaped from broken spars. Killick was bailing. Joe Place and young Ben were stretched out, motionless. The two boats scarcely seemed to move. There were nearly 3 miles to go, and at this rate they would not be able to go halfway before the ebb set in, carrying them far out to sea. Yet the surprise, lying there in the road, had 3 midshipmen aboard, and what they lacked in intelligence they made up for in physical activity. Reed, having but one arm, could no longer go skylarking, hurling himself about the upper rigging regardless of gravity, but his messmates, Norton and Weddell, would hoist him by an easy purchase to astonishing heights, and from these, having still one powerful hand and legs that could twist round any rope, he would plunge with infinite satisfaction. He was at the masthead, negligently holding the starboard main topgallant shrouds with the intention of sliding straight down the whole length of the topgallant backstay, well over 100 feet, when his eye, wandering towards San Lorenzo, caught the odd spectacle of a very small boat trying to tow a much larger one. Even at this distance, the very small boat looked surprisingly like the doctor's pea-green skiff. Leaning down, he called, "Norton!"
"Oh," replied his friend. "Be a decent cove for once and send me up a glass."
Norton, an invariably decent cove, did more than that. He swarmed aloft like an able-bodied baboon, begged Reed to shift over and make room on his tiny foothold, unslung the telescope and handed it over, all this with no more gasping than if he had walked up one pair of stairs. Reed, using a telescope from the masthead, was a sight to turn a landsman pale. He had to pull the tubes right out, twist his one arm through the shrouds, set the small end to his eye, and bring all into focus by a steady pressure. Norton was used to it, however, and he only said,
"Let's have a go, mate, when you've done. Don't be all bloody night."
Reed's reply was a hail as loud as his breaking voice could make it.
"On deck there! On deck! Mr. Granger, sir! Right on the beam! Captain Pullings is trying to tow the Alastor's launch! Launch all mangled! Something cruel! They are bailing in a bad way! Captain is pulling, and I can make out Bondon, but—"
The rest was drowned in a vehement cry of all hands and the launching of boats regardless of new paint, not yet dry. The Alastor's launch and the skiff came alongside under the larboard chains. Bondon mechanically hooked on, and as hands ran down with the man-ropes, Pullings came scrambling aft to help his captain go aboard.
"Where is the doctor?"
asked Jack, looking up at the rail.
"He's ashore, sir, and has been these 5 or 6 days. He said to say he was a-naturalizing in the mountains."
"Very good,"
said Jack, strangely disappointed, aware of an emptiness. He managed to get up the side with a shove, but only just. Even in his present state, he loved his ship, and he was heartily glad to be alive and aboard her again, but he could not cope with the quarterdeck's awed congratulations, nor with the open amazement of all hands before the mast. He went as steadily as he could down the companion ladder and to his cabin, and when he had drunk 4 pints of water, more, he thought vaguely, would amount to that excess so fatal to cows, horses, and sheep, he looked at Place and Ben in their hammocks, washed the filth from his person, threw off his clothes, ate 6 eggs with soft tack, followed by a whole watermelon, and stretched out on his cot, his eyes closing as his head went down. A little after sunset, he climbed up from a bottomless sleep in a ship as silent as the grave, the light fading fast. He gathered himself into the present, collecting the immediate past, thanked God for his delivery, and then said,
"But what's amiss? Am I really here and alive?"
He moved, feeling himself. The weakness was authentic, so was his gummed-up, itching eye and his unshaven face. So was his consuming thirst.
"Ahoy there!"
he called, but without much conviction.
"Sir?"
cried Grimble, Killick's mate.
"Light along a jug of water, just tinged with wine."
And when he had drained it, he asked, gasping,
"Why is the ship so quiet? No bells. Is anyone dead?"
"No, sir. But Captain Pudding said any sorter's rope you should have 100 lashes."
Jack nodded and said,
"Let me have some warm water, and pass the word for Badine and the doctor's young man."
They came, but a grim, bent Killick came hobbling in with them, and for a moment Jack thought he would have to top it the tartar, which he could hardly bear. He had underestimated their kindness, however, for without any wrangling they divided the task. Padine, the acknowledged surgical dresser, very gently removed the soaking bandage. Fabian replaced the exhausted salves with others from the medicine chest. Killick applied them, stating that as far as he could see in this light, the eye had not suffered, but that he would give a considered judgment come the morning. And Padine dressed the place again.
"Will I shave your toll, sir, dear?"
he asked.
"Sure you would lay.
"More easy," said Killick. Shaved and looking almost like a man that might live, Jack received Pullings at the setting of the watch.
"How do you feel, sir?"
asked Tom in a hushed voice.
"Pretty well, I thank you,"
said Jack.
"But tell me, have you had any word of Dutour?"
"Dutour? No, sir," said Tom, amazed.
"He has contrived a run, stowing away either in the launch or possibly the Alistair herself. The doctor told me to keep him aboard, and we must get him back."
"How shall we set about it, sir?" asked Pullings.
"That indeed is a question. Perhaps the doctor will come back tonight. Perhaps I shall be cleverer in the morning. But meanwhile, how does the barkie come to look so trim and spry? How does she come to be out of the yard so soon?"
"Why, sir," said Pullings, laughing, "we were all very much at sea, our notions all a-hoo. When the shipwrights had her clear, all we found was a stretch of copper clean gone, not much bigger than that table. A whale, no doubt. But the worm had been at it quite amazingly. It still kept the water out, more or less, but all the members around it worked something horrid in anything of a sea. They cut the whole piece back to soundwood, replaced it as pretty as ever Pompey could have done, and clapped on new copper twice as thick as ours. There were those few knees that we knew about, and some we did not. But the Wrights were honest fellows. They made little of it. And now we are as stiff as ever you could wish."
"Just where—"
began Jack. But on deck the cry,
"The boat ahoy! What boat is that?"
interrupted him. "I dare say that will be Father Panda," said Pullings. "He usually comes about this time asking for news of you."
"Does he, Tom?"
cried Jack, flushing.
"Let him be brought below at once. And, Tom, keep the after part of the quarterdeck clear, will you?"
"Of course, sir," said Pullings, and inclined his head to catch the deep, resonant answer to the frigate's hail. He said, "That's him, all right. Perhaps he may be able to tell us how to get hold of Dutour." During the inexpert thumping and rattling of the boat along the side, and the cries of, "Ship your oar, sir! Clap on to the painter, Bill! Here's t'other man rope, father! Hold tight!" he said, "Oh, sir, I forgot to tell you, Franklin is in the offing with what looks like a prize. I will go and bring the Reverend below." Sam was even taller and more massive than when he and his father had last met. Jack rose with a double effort, put his hands on those broad shoulders, and said,
"Sam, how very glad I am to see you."
Sam's great flashing smile lit up his face, and he, clasping Jack, cried,
"Oh, sir!"
Then his expression changed to one of the utmost concern as he saw the bandage, and he went on,
"But you are wounded. You are ill. Let you sit down."
He guided Jack to his chair, lowered him gently into it, and sat under the hanging lamp, gazing at him, drawn, lined, and ravaged as he was, with such troubled affection that Jack said,
"Never take on so, dear Sam. My eye is all right, I believe. I can see pretty well. And for the rest, we had a rough time of it on a lee shore in the Alistair's launch during the easterly blow. She was stove, dismasted, lost our food and water. Nothing to eat but a raw sea lion. We have been forced back past the Sea Lion Island 7 times, and I said, 'Shipmates, if we don't get round and run clear on this tack, we shall have a dirty night of it.' Well, we did get round, but we did not run clear. There was a reef on the far side, and in avoiding it we became embayed. A lee shore, in a strong gale, heavy seas, tide and current all setting us in, grapnel coming home. We had our dirty night, true enough, but it lasted 4 mortal days.
However, we patched her up, more or less brought her in. It is all over now, and we have earned a thundering good supper."
He pulled the bell and called for the best supper the ship and his cook could produce. But to his distress he saw tears running down that ebony face. And to change the current of Sam's thoughts, he said,
"Have you seen the doctor? I had hoped he would be aboard, but he has not yet returned."
"Sure, I have seen him, sir. I am after leaving him in the mountain."
"He is quite well. I'm so happy. I was anxious for him."
The first part of the supper came in, cold things the captain's cook had under his hand with the ship lying off a plentiful market. Roast beef yielded up by the gunroom with barely a sigh, chickens, capons, ducks, ham, quantities of vegetables and a great bowl of mayonnaise, decanters of Peruvian wine, a jug of barley water that Jack emptied without thinking of it. He ate voraciously, swallowing as fast as a wolf, but he both talked at quick intervals between bites and listened.
"We had a prisoner called Dutor,"
he said, spreading butter on his soft tack.
"We took him out of the Franklin, a privateer under American colours. He was a Frenchman with enthusiastic visionary notions about an ideal community in a Polynesian island. No church, no king, no laws, no money. Everything held in common. Perfect peace and justice. All to be accomplished, as far as I could make out, by the wholesale slaughter of the islanders. He was a wealthy man, the doctor told me, and I think he owned the Franklin, but that was not clear. At all events, he had no letter of marque, though he or his skipper had preyed on our whalers, and strictly I should have carried him back to England, where they would have hanged him for piracy. I did not like him at all, neither his ideas nor his manners. A confident scrub, very much the foreigner. But he did have some qualities. He was courageous, and he was good to his people. And it seemed to me, Sam, the bottle stands by you, that piracy, where he was concerned, was too much like a lawyer's quibble, so I meant to put him ashore here and let him go on parole. He was what is ordinarily called a gentleman, an educated man with money at all events."
He set about the cold roast beef, and when he had filled their plates he went on,
"An educated man. He knew Greek. You know Greek, Sam, I'm sure."
"A little, sir. We are obliged to, you know, the New Testament being written in Greek."
"In Greek?"
cried Jack, his fork poised in the air.
"I had no idea. I thought it would naturally be written in... What do those wicked Jews speak?"
"Hebrew, sir."
"Just so. But, however, they wrote it in Greek, the clever dogs. I'm amazed."
"Only the New Testament, sir. And it was not quite the same as Homer or Hesiod."
"Oh, indeed. Well, I dined in the gunroom one day when he was also invited, and he told the company about those Olympic Games."
He gazed round the almost empty table, filled Sam's glass, and said,
"I wonder what comes next."
Beef steak and mutton chops came next, hot and hot, and a dish of true potatoes, fresh from their native Andes.
"The Olympic Games, and how they valued the prizes. There was one of these seven sages, you know, a cove by the name of Kylon, whose son gained one, and the old gentleman, the sage, I mean, died of joy. I remembered him and his mates, one of my very few pieces of classical learning, because when I was a little chap they gave me a book with a blue cover and a cut of the seven sages in it, all looking very much alike, that I had to learn out of. And it began, 'First Solon, who made the Athenian laws, then Kylon in Sparta, renowned for his saws.' But surely, Sam, dropping down dead shows a very wrong set of ideas in a sage."
"Very wrong indeed, sir,"
said Sam, looking at his father with great affection.
"To be sure, he was only a sort of ironmonger, but even so. I once had a splendid filly that I hoped might win the Oaks, but if she had, I hope I should not have dropped down dead. In fact, she never ran, and now I come to think of it, the doctor suspected that her lack of barrel betrayed a want of bottom." "Yes. But in my pleasure at being in your company and eating and drinking at last, I talk too much, almost like the French scrub du tour. And when you are fagged, the wine goes to your head, so I wander from the point."
"Not at all, sir. Not at all at all. Will I help you to a chop?"
"By all means." "Well, the point is this. When we were lying off Callao, I happened to tell the doctor that I was sending some French prisoners in."
"Not du tour," cried he.
And then in a low voice, "That might be impolitic. Now, this is rather delicate, and I am puzzled quite how to put it. Let us eat our pudding, if we are allowed any pudding on such short notice. And when we reach port, perhaps my intellects will shine out afresh."
They were allowed pudding, but only apologetical fancies, such as sago, summer's pudding made with what Peru could afford, and mere rice, rather than those true puddings based on suet which called for hours and hours in the copper. Jack told Sam of a fine great sago palm forest in the island of Seram, in which he had walked with his midshipmen, and how they had laughed at the spectacle. A sago forest! These trifles, barely worth attention, were soon dispatched. The cloth was drawn, the port set on Jack's right hand, and Grimble was told that he might turn in.
"Well now, Sam," said Jack, "you must know that when the doctor goes ashore it is not always just for botanizing or the like. Sometimes it is rather more in the political line, if you follow me. For example, he is very much against slavery, and in this case he might encourage people of the same opinion here in Peru. Certainly, by all means, very praiseworthy. But the authorities might take it amiss. The authorities in a slave state might take it amiss. So when he said it would perhaps be impolitic for Dutor, who knows his opinions, to be set ashore, he may very well have seen the man as an informer. And there are other aspects that I will not touch upon. Shoal water that I am not acquainted with. Shoal water and no chart. But to come to the point at last, Sam, you must forgive me for being so slow, roundabout, and prosy. I find it hard to concentrate my mind this evening. But the point is this. Dutoil has contrived to get ashore. I'm very much afraid he may do the doctor harm, and I mean to do everything I can to get the fellow back on board. I beg you will help me, Sam.
Sir, said Sam, I am yours to command. The doctor and I understand one another very well where his present activities are concerned. He has consulted me to some extent. I too am very much opposed to slavery and to French domination. So are many men I know. And as you say, there are other aspects. As for the miserable Dutor, I am afraid he is beyond our reach, having been taken up by the Holy Office last Saturday. He is now in the Casa de la Inquisición, and I fear things will go very badly for him once the questioning has finished. He was a most publicly violent, blasphemous, atheistical wretch, but he has already done all the harm he can do. The doctor's friends had arranged a change in government, and since the Viceroy was away, everything was moving rapidly and smoothly towards the desired end. Troops were being moved and bridges secured, all the necessary precautions for a peaceful change, when Dutor appeared. He said the doctor was an English agent and that the whole operation was set a-going with the help of English gold by purchased traitors. Nobody took much notice of such an enthusiast, a Frenchman into the bargain, stained with the crime of their revolution and Napoleon's against the Pope. But a vile official, one Castro, a black thief, thought he might seize upon it to curry favour with the Viceroy, and he made a great noise, hiring a mob to shout in the streets and stone foreigners. The whole city was alive with it. The chief general cried off, the movement collapsed, and his friends advised the doctor to leave the country at once. He is in the far mountains by now, travelling with a sure, experienced guide towards Chile, which has a separate government. We consulted together before he left, and it was agreed that I should tell you he would do his utmost to be in Valparaiso by the last day of next month, staying either with the Benedictines or with Don Jaime O'Higgins. Obviously he cannot travel so far over such a country in that period, but once he is in Chile, we hope that he will be able to travel on by a series of small coasting vessels from one little port or fishing village to another, and so reach Valparaiso in good time. We further agreed, sir, that until the Viceroy's return, which will be in 3 or 4 days now, you need have no fear for the ship, and even then direct seizure is unlikely. But we were told on good authority that you would be well advised to move her out of the yard, as indeed Captain Pullings has done, to avoid any vexatious measures, such as detention for some alleged debt or the like. For example, a woman is prepared to swear that Joseph Place, a member of your crew, has got her with child. Then again, our confidential friends, men of business, all assert that you should sell your prizes directly, or if the offer do not suit, send them down to Arica, or even Coquimbo. Or even Coquimbo,
repeated Sam in the all-pervading silence.
But I will tell it you all again, so I will, at 8:30 tomorrow,
he whispered.
God bless now.
Sam was an even larger man than his father, but he could move even more quietly. Rising now, he moved back towards the door, opened it without a sound, stood there for a moment, listening to Jack's long, even breathing, and vanished into the shadowy half-deck. After a week or 10 days of steady up and down, but very much more up than down, Stephen was of opinion that his head and lungs had adapted themselves to the thin air of the mountains. He had, after all, walked and ridden all day from their last night's resting place, rising through the high alpine pastures to perhaps 9,000 feet without discomfort. Admittedly, he could not have kept up hour after hour with the deep-chested Indians, several of them Aymaras from Eduardo's native Cuzco, who led the train of pack llamas up the interminable slopes, many of them so desperately barren. Yet when he dismounted and walked out with Eduardo over some promising stretch of country, he did so as nimbly as if he were treading the Curragh of Kildare. Three times that day, and at ever-increasing heights, they had left their mules in the hope of a partridge or a guanaco, and three times they had caught up with the llamas, not indeed empty-handed, since Stephen carried a beetle or a low-growing plant for the pack of the animal that carried their collections, but without any sort of game, which meant that their supper would be fried guinea pig and dried potatoes once more. And each time Eduardo had said that this was a strange, unaccountable year, with weather that made no sense, and with animals abandoning customs and territories that had remained unchanged since before the days of Pachacutic Inca. To prove his point, on the third occasion, he led Stephen to a heap of dung, wonderfully unexpected and even homely in so desolate a landscape. A heap, 6 feet across and several inches high in spite of weathering. Stephen looked at it attentively. Ruminants droppings, without a doubt. And Eduardo told him that guanacos always came to the same place to defecate, came from a great way off, it was a natural law among them. But here, in this ancestral heap, so useful as fuel, nothing whatsoever had been deposited for months. The whole surface and the periphery were old, worn, and perfectly dry. This subversion of all that was right, and the shame of promising birds and beasts that did not appear, made Eduardo as nearly morose as his cheerful, sanguine nature would allow, and for part of the afternoon they rode in silence. During this long stretch, when the faint track rose steadily through broken, rocky country towards a far, high, rounded crest, the train moved on with barely a sound. The Indians, whose high arched noses and large dark eyes made them look quite like their llamas, talked little, and that in low voices. During all this time, Stephen had not been able to establish human relations with a single one of them, any more than he had with their animals, and this in spite of the fact that they were together day and night, since Eduardo kept to remote trails far from all towns and frequented roads, the llamas carrying everything needed for their journey. It is true that they had seen two very long caravans carrying ore down from the isolated mines right up just under the snow line, but these only accentuated their loneliness, not unlike that of a ship in mid-ocean. One slight consolation was that by now only a few of the more froward llamas spat at him. Up and up. Up and up. With his eyes fixed, unseeing, on the gravelly soil and thin grass of the track as it flowed steadily beneath his larboard stirrup, a great hollowed block of wood, Stephen's mind floated off 10,000 miles to Diana and Bridget. How did they do? Was it right in a man to marry, and then to sail off to the far side of the world for years on end? An Aymara Indian of a superior kind, with a red worsted cap, struck him sharply on the knee, speaking in a severe, disapproving tone, and pointing.
"Don Esteban," called Eduardo again from some little way ahead. "We are almost on the edge of the Puna. If you would like to dismount, I believe I could really show you something this time."
Stephen looked up. Immediately ahead was a low red cliff, and on its top, the rounding crest towards which they had been travelling so long, now suddenly quite close. They must have mounted another 2,000 or 3,000 feet, he reflected, taking notice of the still thinner air, the sharper cold.
"We will join them round the next bend," said Eduardo, leading him towards a shaly path up the cliff, while the llamas carried on along the trail, quite broad and distinct at this point.
"This was no doubt a mine," observed Eduardo, pointing to a tunnel and a spoil heap. "Or an attempt at a mine."
Stephen nodded. They had passed no mountain, however bare, remote, waterless, and inaccessible, without the mark of men having been there, searching for gold, silver, copper, cinnabar, or even tin. He said nothing. His heart was already beating so as to fill his bosom, leaving no room for breath. He reached the top, but only just, and stood there controlling, or trying to control, his violent gasps, while Eduardo named the great shining snowy peaks that soared on either hand and in front, all rising like islands from an orange belt of cloud, one behind the other, brilliant in the cold, transparent air.
"Now," he said, turning to Stephen, "I believe I shall take your breath away."
Stephen gave a weak, mechanical smile and followed him carefully over the tufts of coarse yellow grass. Trees had been left behind, long, long ago, and here there was not even a hint of a bush, not even of a prostrate bush, only the near sterility of ichu grass stretching away and away forever over this high, stark plateau. And the ground looked flat, but in fact it rose and fell, and pausing by a rocky outcrop, Eduardo gave Stephen a significant, triumphant look. Stephen, half-blind by now, followed his gaze down the slope, and to his utter amazement he saw a scattered grove of what, for a moment, he took to be thick-stemmed palm trees, about 15 feet high. But some of them had a great solid spike, rising as much again above the palm-like crown. He ran unsteadily to the nearest. The leaves were like those of an agave, fierce, pointed, and with hooked thorns all along their sides. The great spike was an ordered mass of close-packed flowers, pale yellow, thousands and thousands of them.
"Mother of God!" he said.
And after a while, "It is a bromeliad."
"Yes, sir," said Eduardo, delighted, proprietorial. "We call it a puya."
"Ruiz did not know it. Nowhere is it described, still less figured in the Flora Peruviani et Chilensis. What would Linnaeus have made of such a plant? Oh, oh!" he cried,
for there, as incongruous in this severity as the bromeliad, flew, or rather darted, minute green hummingbirds, hovering at an open flower, sipping its honey, flashing on to the next, taking no notice of him whatever. A week later and 2,000 feet higher, Stephen and Eduardo walked out across the flank of a quiescent volcano at a fine, brisk pace. On the left hand, a chaos of rocks, some enormous. On the right, a vast sweep of volcanic ash, old, settled ash, now just blushing green from a recent shower. They were carrying their guns, for in the puna beyond this chaos there was a possibility of Eduardo's partridges. But their main purpose was to contemplate a lofty rock face with an inaccessible ledge upon which the condor had nested in the past, and might well be nesting now. They threaded the chaos, and although the north-facing boulders were coated with old ice, they found several interesting plants among them, as well as some droppings that Eduardo pointed out as being those of a vicuña.
"How do they differ from those of a guanaco?" asked Stephen.
"Apart from the fact that they lie separately rather than in a family heap, I should find it difficult to say," replied Eduardo. "But if you were to see the two side by side, you would distinguish them at once. This is low for a vicuña, however. He must have come down for the fresh green on the other side."
"Perhaps we may get a shot at him," said Stephen. "You yourself said that you were tired of fried guinea pig and ham."
"So I did," said Eduardo.
And then, hesitantly,
"But, dear Don Esteban, it would grieve me if you were to kill him. The Incas have always protected the vicuña, and even the Spaniards leave him alone in general. My followers would take it very ill."
"Sure, he is safe from me, yet my best poncho is made from vicuña's wool."
"Certainly, they are killed from time to time, and by certain people. There is our condor."
There he was indeed, black in a dark blue sky, wheeling towards his still distant cliff. They watched him out of sight. Stephen did not return to the vicuña. Eduardo was embarrassed, and there was obviously some question of the old ways here. He and his followers were no doubt practicing Catholics, but this did not prevent them from dipping one finger in their cup and holding it up to thank the sun before drinking, as their ancestors had done time out of mind. And there were other ceremonies of the same nature.
"As you know," said Eduardo, "the chick cannot fly until his second year. So if he is there, and if the light is what I could wish, we may see him peering over the edge."
"Could we not climb up and look down on him?"
"Heavens, no," cried Eduardo. "We should never get down before sunset, and it is terrible to be caught by night on the puna. Do but think of the terrible evening winds, the terrible morning winds, and the wicked cold. Nothing to eat, nothing to drink, no shelter at all."
Stephen was thinking of these things as they walked across an accidented stretch of country when, Rounding a tumble of rock, they heard the squealing neigh of a guanaco. They stopped short, and there on the left hand stood the guanaco they had heard, while still farther to the left a string of others fled at a great pace, vanishing down the slope. The guanaco neighed again, louder, still more shrill, stamped the tall, spiky ichu grass with his front feet, and began rearing and waving his head in a great passion, never yielding a foot as they approached.
"He is challenging you," said Eduardo. "He has been fighting. Look at the blood on his sides. He may attack you presently. You should not ask for a better shot, nor a better supper."
"But I must not shoot him?"
"Why, Don Esteban," cried Eduardo, "how can you speak so? He is no vicuña. He is much too big for a vicuña and the wrong color. He is a guanaco and a perfectly fair quarry for you."
Stephen's piece had one barrel loaded with shot, the other with ball. He knelt, which enraged the guanaco, took careful aim and fired. The animal, struck in the heart, gave a great bound and disappeared, apparently collapsing in the long grass.
"The first day we eat steaks, minced, very fine," said Eduardo, as they hurried up the slope. "The next day, in the sun, his shoulders grow quite tender."
Eduardo could be as cheerful as any European, but it was clearly part of his ancestral code to show no adverse emotion, a stoic calm. Yet now his look of eager expectation changed to one of plain, blank, undisguised dismay. The guanaco had in fact been capering on the edge of a chasm, and its convulsive leap had carried it over. 200 feet below them he lay, and the cliff dropped sheer. They pondered, searching in vain for any way down. They measured the declining sun, the shadows rising below them. Unwillingly they turned. And as they turned, first the male condor, and then his mate, began their first wheeling sweeps high overhead. Another day, on the high puna yet again, coming back from a small alpine lake, the source of a stream that eventually flowed into the Amazon and so on to the Atlantic, though from here on clear mornings they could make out the gleam of the South Sea, a lake on whose frozen bank Eduardo had shown Stephen that handsome goose, the huachua, with a white body and dark green wings, they paused in still another group of puyas. Some of them growing among rocks so conveniently placed that Stephen was able to gather seed from the lower flower. It was late, but for once the evening was as calm as the day, and the llama train was clearly in sight on the trail below.
"Let us walk down wide," said Eduardo, looking to his flint. "I still have hopes."
"Very well," said Stephen.
And they went down the slope abreast, 20 yards apart. When they were a stone's throw from the trail, a fair-sized bird sprang from a tuft with a whirr of wings. It was clearly Eduardo's bird, and he fired, hitting it so hard that it bounced again.
"There," he cried, as happy as a boy, "here is my partridge at last, or at least what the Spaniards call a partridge."
"A very handsome bird, too, so it is," said Stephen, turning it over and over. "And to be sure, there is a superficial resemblance to a partridge, though I doubt it is a gallinaceous bird at all."
"So do I. We call it and its cousin, tuya."
"I believe it is one of Latham's tinamous."
"I am sure you are right. A very curious thing about the tuya is that the cockbird broods the eggs, sometimes the eggs of several hens, like the rhea. Possibly there is some connection."
"Sure, the bill is not unlike—" "But you will never tell me you have rheas at this exorbitant height?"
"We certainly have, and higher still. Not the blundering great rheas of the pampas, but fine grey birds that stand no more than 4 feet high and run like the wind. God willing, I shall bring you in sight of some on the Altiplano, soon after we leave the monastery."
"How good and kind you are, dear Eduardo. I look forward to it with the keenest anticipation," said Stephen.
And having felt the bird's skeleton under its plump breast, "I fairly long to dissect him."
"That would mean fried guinea pig again," observed Eduardo.
"Not if we confine our attention to his bones," said Stephen. "A bird very gently seethed for some hours will always leave his bones in the pot. You will say that his flesh is not that of the same bird roasted, which is very true, but how much better, even so, than our eternal guinea pig?"
The monastery of which Eduardo had spoken was 5 days' journey to the southeast, but the prospect of the Altiplano rears, the salt lakes with their different kinds of flamingo, and the unending deserts of pure white salt itself lent Stephen Maturin wings, and, helped by unnaturally kind weather, they reached the high, lonely mission in four, although they were loaded with the spoils of Lake Titicaca, the skins of two flightless grebes, two different species of ibis, a crested duck, and some rails, together with plants and insects. Eduardo and his train appeared well after what little dusk there was in such a latitude and at such a height. They had to hammer on the outward gate and bawl a great while before it opened, and when at last they were admitted, worried and discontented looks received them. The building had been a mission belonging to the Society of Jesus until that order was suppressed. Now it was inhabited by Capuchins, and the friars, though no doubt good-hearted, pious men, lacked both the learning and the dissimulation often attributed to the Jesuits.
"We did not expect you until tomorrow," said the prior. "Today is Wednesday, not Thursday," said the sub-prior.
"There is nothing to eat," said a friar in the dim background. "Juan Morales was to bring up a roasted pig tomorrow and several hens. Why did you not send to say you were coming today?"
"If you had sent yesterday morning, we could have asked Black Lopez to tell Juan to bring the hog up today. Black Lopez was going down in any case."
After a silence, the brother porter said,
"Well, there may be a few guinea pigs left in the scriptorium." "Run, Brother Jaime," cried the prior. "Let us lift up our hearts, and at least there is always some wine."
"There is always some wine," cried the prior, my dear, wrote Stephen, "and I cannot tell you how well it went down. Nor can I tell you how much I look forward to the next few days, when my amiable companion promises me the wonders of the Altiplano, perhaps even of the edge of the Atacama, where rain falls but once in 100 years. He has already shown me little bright green parakeets in the desolation of bare rock at 15,000 feet, mountain viscachas, fat creatures like rabbits with a squirrel's tail that live among the boulders, piping and whistling cheerfully, and many other delights in those prodigious solitudes with snowy peaks on every hand, some of them volcanoes that glow red by night. And he promises more to come, for extreme conditions beget extremities in every form of life. I could, however, wish that one of the extremities was not the guinea pig or cavy. He is neither beautiful nor intelligent, and he is the most indifferent eating imaginable, barely edible at all, indeed, after the first half-dozen braces. Unhappily, he is readily domesticated. He dries, smokes, or salts easily, and he can be carried forever in this dry, dry, cold air. A cold air in which the native potato, too, can be, and alas, is, dried, frozen, dried again, and so packed up. I've tried to make this dish a little more palatable by adding mushrooms, our ordinary European mushrooms, Agaricus campestris, which to my perfect stupefaction I found growing here in alpine meadows, but my dear companion told me I should certainly drop down dead. His followers too assured me, and one another, that I should swell then drop down dead, and it angered them so when I survived a week that Eduardo had to beg me to stop. I might bring misfortune upon the whole company. They look upon me as an unwholesome being, and I must admit that I cannot congratulate them upon their looks either. At this height, in this cold, and with the incessant effort, their faces grow blue, a dull and somewhat uninviting leaden blue.
He reflected upon these Indians, and upon Eduardo for a while, dipped his pen again, and wrote,
"Will I tell you two things now before I forget them? The first is that there are no ill smells up here, no smells at all. The second,"
he dipped his pen again, but now the ink had frozen, which did not surprise him, and gathering his vicuña poncho round his meagre form, he walked off to his bed, where, when a certain slight degree of warmth had gathered round him, he lay thinking of Eduardo and their conversations all that afternoon as they climbed steadily from La Guerra. Eduardo had given him a detailed account of Pachacutic Inca, the first great conqueror, and his family down to Huayna Capac, the great Inca, to Atahualpa, strangled by Pizarro, and the Inca Manco, Eduardo's ancestor, and of the many still existing collateral families descending from Huayna Capac. It did not surprise Stephen to hear of bitter enmity between cousins, nor of feuds lasting from the earliest times to the present, nor indeed of brother murdering brother. There were, after all, well-established precedents, but it did surprise him after a while to find that the general drift of his friend's conversation seemed more and more to be in the direction of outside support for one particular branch of the royal line, so that it might neutralize the other Quechua clans and unite a sufficient force of Indians and well-wishers to liberate at least Cuzco, their ancestral home. It surprised him because he would have sworn that a man of Eduardo's intelligence must have seen the impossibility of such a scheme, the unbelievable number of totally conflicting interests, the extreme unlikelihood of reconciliation between the hostile groups, the wretched outcome of Tupac Amaru's rising not long since, drowned in blood by the Spaniards with the help of other Indians, some of the royal blood. He concealed his surprise, but he let the words flow past his ears, deliberately forgetting to record the genealogies, the names of those likely to support the cause, and of those already committed. Yet as he lay there unsleeping in the cold, his perversely retentive memory rehearsed these lists, and he was still with the descendants of Huascar Inca when a barefoot friar came in with a charcoal brazier and asked him whether he was awake, because if he was, the prior thought he might like to join them in a novena addressed to Saint Isidore of Seville, begging for his intercession in favour of all travellers. Returning to his now warmer room from this exercise, Stephen fell into a dreaming sleep. Diana, sentenced to death for some unquestioned murder, stood before the judge in an informal court, guarded by a civil but reserved jailoress. She was wearing a nightgown, and the judge, a well-bred man, obviously embarrassed by the situation and by his task, was slowly tying a hangman's knot in a fine new piece of white cordage. Diana's distress increased as the knot reached completion. She looked at Stephen, her eyes darkening with terror. He could do nothing. Still another barefoot friar, looking casually into his cell, expressed some astonishment that Stephen should not yet have joined Don Eduardo and his company. They were there in the courtyard, the pack llamas already loaded and the sun rising over Anacochani. So it was. Yet the western sky was still dark violet at the lower rim, and as he looked at it, Stephen remembered the words he had intended to write to Diana before he put his letter to the candle. "In this still cold air, the stars do not twinkle, but hang there like a covey of planets." For there they were, clear beads of unwinking gold. He could not relish them, however. His dream still oppressed him, and he had to force a smile when Eduardo told him he had reserved a piece of bread for their breakfast instead of dried potatoes, a piece of wheaten bread. The high, querulous voice of the llamas as they set off, the steady clop of his mule striding along the road, the glorious day rising huge overhead in a sky of immeasurable height, and on every hand brown mountains capped with white, the thin and piercing air growing warm as the sun climbed well above the peaks. Nobody spoke much, nor would they do so until the warmth and the exercise had loosened their powerful chests. The breath still came steaming from them all, and all seemed totally absorbed by their own reflections. Yet the train had not gone 2 miles or three before a long, wavering Aymara howl stopped each man in his stride. It was a short, stocky Indian, just coming into sight behind them, rounding a curve in the mountainside. He was a great way off, but in this brilliant clarity, Eduardo at once said, "Quipus." On either side of him his fellows murmured, "Quipus."
"I am sure you have often seen Quipus, Don Esteban," said Eduardo. "Never in life, my dear," replied Stephen. "You will see them presently," said Eduardo.
And they watched the far small man as he came running steadily along the track, his coloured staff rising and falling.
"They are knotted cords and thin strips of cloth, our kind of writing, concise, ingenious secret. I am a sinful creature, but on no more than a few inches I can record all I must remember at confession, and only I can read it, since the first knot gives the clue to all the rest."
The messenger came running along the line. His face was blue, but his breath was even, unhurried. He kissed Eduardo's knee, unwound the coloured cords and strips from his staff, and handed them up. The train moved on. Stephen gathered his reins.
"No," said Eduardo. "Pray watch. You will see me read them as quick as a clearly written letter."
This he did. But as he read, his expression changed. His pleasant, ingenuous young face closed, and at the end he said,
"I beg your pardon, Don Esteban. I thought it was just my agent in Cuzco asking whether he might send a draft of llamas to Potosí. this being the runner who usually brings his messages. But now it is quite another matter. We must go no farther south. Gayongos has a ship for Valparaiso that will touch at Arica. We must cut across by the Huecho Pilan. It is a high pass, Don Esteban, but you will not mind a high pass. I am very sorry I must forego the pleasure of showing you the rears of the Altiplano this time and the great wastes of salt, but not far from the Huecho Pilan there is a lake on which I can almost promise you some most uncommon ducks and geese, gulls too, and rails. Forgive me.
He spurred along the track, and as Stephen slowly followed, he heard him giving orders that sent three quarters of the train back along the road, such as it was. Stephen was intimately convinced that the Quipus had brought news of some hostile cousins waiting for Eduardo in the context of that movement for liberation he had touched upon the day before, as well as word of Gayongo's ship, which might more sensibly have put in a little farther south in the realm of Chile. For Arica, as both he and Eduardo knew, was still in the government of Peru. Yet pointing out the obvious could only cause distress, fruitless argument, bad blood. The greater part of the returning band flowed round him as he sat there on his mule, passing silently, with apparent indifference, or at the most a certain veiled disapproval. Riding on to join those who remained, he saw Eduardo's face, impassive and firmly in command, though his eyes sometimes wandered towards Stephen with some hint of anxious questioning. Stephen still said nothing, yet he did observe that now their company was made up of the abler-looking, and indeed more amiable, men, leading the stronger beasts, and they with larger packs. On, and within half an hour their quiet rhythm had returned. At noon they were on a broad, stony platform, bare flat rock at the convergence of three mountain spurs, hot in the sun, and here their track could no longer be seen at all. Yet neither Eduardo nor his men seemed in any way concerned. They marched steadily across and turned right-handed where the westernmost spur ran down to the little plain, travelling steadily on through a sheltered and relatively fertile stretch of country, green here and there with tola bushes and shaggy with coarse yellow grass. The going was easier, much clearer in direction, and smoother by far.
"We have struck into one of the Inca post roads," said Eduardo, breaking the silence. "In a little while, where there is marshy ground by day, it is paved. My ancestors may not have known the wheel, but they did know how to make roads. Beyond the marshy piece, where we may put up some wildfowl, there is a great tumble of boulders from an earthquake so long ago that they are covered with lichen, and not only lichen, but a very curious woody fungus that I believe you may not have seen. It is called yarreta, and it grows at this height from here to the westward, and together with guanaco dung the heads make excellent firing. The rockfall abounds with viscachas, and if we take our guns we may be spared guinea pig for a great while. Viscachas are capital eating. But, Doctor, I am afraid you are sad. I am so sorry to have disappointed you of our Altiplano rears.
I am not at all disappointed, friend. I have seen a little flock of white-winged finches, and a bird I took to be a mountain caracara.
Eduardo was unconvinced. He looked into Stephen's face and said,
"Still, if only this weather holds,"
glancing anxiously at the pure sky overhead,
"we should reach the pass in 3 days, and we will surely find wonders on my lake."
On the morning of the second day the pass was clearly to be seen, a little above the snow line between two matching peaks that soared another 5,000 feet, brilliant white in the almost horizontal sun.
"There is the post-house," said Eduardo, pointing his glass, "just under the snow and a little to the right. It was built by Huayna Capac, and it is as strong as ever. The pass is high, as you see, but on the far side there is an easy road downhill all the way to one of my brother's silver mines, and a village where they grow the best potatoes in Peru, as well as corn and barley. And they breed excellent llamas. These animals all came from there, and that is one of the reasons that they step out so well. It is true that after that we have to cross a chasm, with the Uribu flowing far below, but there is a hanging bridge in quite good repair, and you do not dislike heights that fill weak minds with horror. Sailors pay no attention to heights. A circumnavigator is inured to prodigious heights. What have you found, Don Esteban?"
"A curious beetle."
"Very curious indeed. One day I shall really set myself to the study of beetles, My lake, too, is on the far side. It seems to me that we should reach the post-house in plenty of time for the men to settle in and for you and me to go on to my lake. At this time of year, it will not even skim over with ice until well after sunset, and we may find ducks and geese by the hundred. We will take Molina, the best llama, to carry what we shoot.
If you are as mistaken about the birds as you are about my head for heights, Molina will have no great burden to carry at all, reflected Stephen, who had often heard, each time with deeper dismay, of the spidery Inca bridges upon which intrepid Indians crossed torrents raging 1,000 feet below them, even hauling immobilized animals over by means of a primitive windlass, the whole construction swaying wildly to and fro as even a single traveller reached the middle, the first false step being the last. "How long does it take to fall 1,000 feet?" he asked himself, and as the troop set out he tried to make the calculation, but his arithmetical powers were, and always had been, weak. "Long enough to make an act of contrition, at all events," he said, abandoning the answer of 7 hours and odd seconds as absurd. On and on, up and up. This had been the pattern for a great while, but now the up and up was growing far more pronounced. Now it was often a question of leading his mule again, and now he had to concentrate his mind on keeping up wherever the road grew steep. His breath was coming short, his heart beat 120 strokes a minute, his eyesight wavered.
"You are in a brown study, I find," said Eduardo, whose spirits had revived with the altitude.
"I was contemplating on the physiology of animals that live in a rarefied atmosphere," said Stephen. "Surely the exact dissection of a vicuña would show some very remarkable adaptations."
"There can be no doubt of it," replied Eduardo, "and at present we too mean to adapt our own persons for the last stretch with a draught of mate. Do you choose to dismount?"
Stephen did so, very carefully avoiding the least hint of unsteadiness. He could scarcely see, but he was most unwilling to show any sign of the mountain sickness that had certainly come upon him. When his head cleared from the effort of swinging out of the saddle, he looked up and saw to his relief that they were now quite near the snow line, above 16,000 feet. He had never been so high, and he had every right to be mountain sick. This was no discreditable weakness. Already smoke was rising from the guanaco dung, the woody fungus heads, and a few of those bushes that burned green, and presently the gourds of mate were passing round. Stephen drew in the hot, cheering gusts through his silver tube, ate a dried peach from Chile, and then, like all the rest, he drew out his pouch of coca leaves, preparing a moderate ball spread with quinoa ash, chewed it slightly to start the flow, and then eased it into his cheek.
The familiar tingling began almost at once, followed by the beginning of that curious numbness which had so startled him many years ago. Mountain sickness faded, anxiety with it. Strength returned. He gazed at the climbing road, the last stretch, 3 steep traverses zigzagging up to the post-house, into the snow and over the pass. It would be walking every step of the way. He did not mind at all.
"Will you not ride, Don Esteban?" said Eduardo, holding the stirrup for him.
"No, sir," said Stephen. "The animal is extremely tired. Look at his hanging lip, God be with him. Whereas I am now quite recovered, a sprightly popinjay."
A little less sprightly by the time they reached the massive post-house, built like some of those sections of the road cut deep into the mountainside, of vast rocks so exactly shaped that they outstripped all reasonable conjecture. A little less sprightly, but perfectly human. He took the liveliest interest in the yarreta fungus growing on these rocks and on the inner walls, and Eduardo said to him,
"How glad I am to see you so brisk. Although we reached here in such good time, I was afraid you might be too tired to see my lake. Do you think that after, say, an hour's rest, you would like to go? There is some cloud in the east, and as you know, winds sometimes get up in the evening, but an hour's rest would still leave us time."
"Dear Eduardo," said Stephen, "the earlier we go, the more we shall see. I fairly dote on alpine lakes, and this one, as I recall, has a fine fringe of reeds."
It had indeed a fine fringe of reeds, A very fine, deep fringe, unique in Stephen Maturin's extensive experience of reeds, in that they grew not out of glutinous mud, but from a layer of broken stones brought down by some not far distant combination of earthquake and flood from one of the nearby glaciers. This allowed them to walk out dry foot with their guns and spyglasses, leaving Molina on a long tether among the clumps of spiny ichu grass. When first they had seen it from above, at some distance, the lake was clearly full of wildfowl, rafts of duck, geese at the far end where a stream from the northern glacier came in, and gulls over all. But by the time they had made their way through to a sheltered point near the open water that allowed them a clear view, although they remained unseen, they found that there were also remarkable numbers of rails, waders, and the smaller herons. "What wealth!" they cried, and began a first eager census of genera, at least, before the identification or attempted identification of species. Presently they grew calmer, leaving the fine work until they could obtain specimens, and they sat at their ease, gazing over the water at a distant crowd of flamingos, gabbling steadily in their goose-like manner, a straggling line of newcomers, pale pink, scarlet and black in the declining sun, passed over to join the rest, and Stephen, watching them as they crossed from left to right, observed, "For me, flamingos belong essentially to the Mediterranean lagoons, by definition at the level of the sea. And to find them up here, in an air so thin it is a wonder that their wings can bear them, gives the whole landscape something of the qualities of a dream. It is true that their voices are slightly different, and that their plumage has a deeper red, but that, if anything, strengthens the impression. Like losing one's way in a familiar town. A sense of..." He broke off as a little band of teal came racing across well within range, and both men cocked their fowling pieces. Eduardo was poised, but seeing Stephen lower his gun, he did not fire. "How absurd," said Stephen. "I quite forgot to ask you how you manage without a dog. We could not have brought them down on land, and no man would ever wade far, unless swim for all love in that cruel, bitter, cold wetness, for anything short of a two-headed phoenix."
"No," said Eduardo. "What we cannot bring down on the shore, we leave where they fall. The lake freezes hard by night, and we pick them up in the morning. But it is strange that you should have spoken of a dream. Waking dream. I have the same feeling, though not at all for the same clear reason. There is something strange here. The birds are not settled. As you see, they are perpetually moving, the groups breaking up, and there is too much noise. They are uneasy. So is Molina. I have heard him 3 times now. There is something unnatural. God send there may not be an earthquake. Amen."
After a long pause, Eduardo said,
"I do not believe I shall kill anything this evening, Don Esteban. What do you say to sitting here and counting and naming as well as we can until the sun is half an hour from Taraluga over there? I have a quipu in my pocket to record them, and then going back across the Huecho Pilan to the post-house, where you can write them down at your leisure."
"With all my heart," said Maturin.
It had become increasingly evident to him that there was a whole series of pieties active in Eduardo's breast, which had nothing to do with those of Christianity as it was ordinarily understood. Furthermore, he was much attached to the young man, and he had not seen him so moved before, even when he received the message from Cuzco. They sat on, noting the passing birds, watching those farther off with their telescopes, comparing observations. And they were talking about the remarkable sense of the ominous or impending change in animals, earthquake, eruption, eclipse, even lunar eclipses in certain bats, when a flock of Huachua geese flew straight at them at an extraordinary speed, passing just over their heads and with so great a rush of wings that for a moment their words were lost. The geese all wheeled together, returned at the same height and speed, rose and then pitched on the water, tearing the surface and throwing it wide. They sat in a tight-packed group, their heads stretched up, and high over them the lake gulls turned, screaming. Screaming. Another minute passed, and a prodigious noise between a great thunderclap and a broadside made both men start up, part the tall reeds and look behind them. They saw the snow of the 2 peaks on either side of the pass streaming out to leeward, streamers a mile long and more, then peaks, and the pass itself vanished in a white turmoil.
"It may not last," cried Eduardo, catching up his gun.
Stephen followed him as he went fast through the reeds to the place where they had left the llama. And indeed for some minutes it seemed that this one clap might be the end, but while Eduardo was fastening their belongings to the llama's pack saddle, Stephen looked at the water. There was scarcely a creature left on it now, and all along the edge birds were pushing in among the reeds. Moving at that quick, familiar, short-paced Indian trot, Eduardo and the llama set off over the powdering of snow for the true snow line and the pass. There was still enough day and enough light to cross it even going at a moderate pace. A second thunderclap, a triple roar several times repeated, and first the wind and then the snow engulfed them. Stephen, who weighed no great matter, was thrust first forward, then violently back, then plucked bodily up and flung against a rock. For a while he could see nothing, and crouched there, shielding his face so that he should not breathe the flying powdered snow, Eduardo, who like the llama had thrown himself down at the first blast, found him, passed the tether round his waist and told him to hold on and keep moving for the love of God. Eduardo knew the path perfectly well. They would reach the snow line and move on bent low, much easier up there, no hard falling, and the top of the pass would be blown clear. But it was not. When at last they had beaten their slow, gasping way up through the roaring, uneven wind in the increasing darkness, they found that hitherto they had been in the relatively sheltered lee of the topmost ridge, and that the pass itself received not only the full force of the blast, but of that blast concentrated and magnified by the two converging sides of rock. The space between was a racing, downward torrent of air and snow that now partook more and more of the cutting, icy crust from the snowfields far to windward. It was quite impassable. The sun had vanished in a white blur at some forgotten or unnoticed point, but by the grace of God, a four-day moon, gleaming at odd moments through breaks in the clouds of flying snow, enabled Eduardo to reach a cleft in the rock face. It just allowed them to shelter from the direct buffeting of the wind, if not from its shattering noise, and to some degree from the rapidly increasing and mortal cold. It was a triangular cleft, the outer part filled with powdered snow. Eduardo kicked it into the mainstream, where it vanished instantly, thrust Stephen right into the sharp apex, followed him, dragging the llama into the opening where it lay on the remaining snow, and squatted between the two. The llama tried to heave itself farther in, but this could not be. After a struggle, Eduardo managed to shackle one bent knee, and the poor beast gave up, lowering its long neck across them, with its head on Stephen's knee. Gradually, as they recovered from the immense exertion of the last 100 yards or so, and as their ears grew more accustomed to the wind's countless voices, all different, all enormously loud and oppressive in this shrieking pass, they exchanged a few words. Eduardo begged pardon for leading Don Esteban into this. He should have known there were signs. Tepec had told him it was a haunted, unlucky day. But these winds died with the midnight stars, or at least with the rising sun. Would the doctor like a ball of coca leaves? Stephen had been so very near death, from a racing heart, an inability to breathe at such a height, and physical exhaustion, that he had almost forgotten his pouch. And at this point he did not possess the bodily strength or the spiritual resolution to grope for it under his clothes. He accepted gratefully, fumbling across the llama's neck for the proffered quid. It had not been in his cheek 5 minutes before the extremity, the most mortal extremity of fatigue, died away. In 10 minutes he was perfectly capable of reaching his own supply of leaves and ash, and of rearranging himself with what small degree of physical comfort the space allowed. He also felt a certain grateful warmth from the llama's head, but quite apart from that, mental comfort and a sense of divorce from time and immediate contingencies were already settling in his mind. They talked a little, or rather shouted, about the desirability of a thick drift of snow across the entrance, yet the steadily increasing cold made the effort of shouting too great, and each relapsed into a meditative silence, carefully spreading what clothes they had over the whole of their persons, particularly ears, noses, fingers. What passed for time, or at least a kind of duration, no doubt went on. Sleep in these circumstances seemed wholly out of the question, even if it had not been for the effect of coca leaves, stronger by far than any coffee known to man, above all in the present heavy and steadily repeated doses. Yet at some remote given point, Stephen's waking mind distinctly perceived the minute voice of the watch deep in his bosom, striking 5, and then the half. "Can this be?" he asked. and feeling deep within his bosom he pressed the repeating knob. 5, said the watch again, and then the shriller half. At the same moment he realized that the wind had stopped, that the llama's head and neck were cold, the creature already stiff, that Eduardo was breathing deep, that his own leg, no longer covered by the poncho these many hours, had no sensibility whatsoever, and that the mouth of the cleft, now almost entirely closed by a great deal of fresh snow, had a line of light at the top.
"Eduardo!" he called, when he had digested all these things and arranged them in order. "Eduardo! God and Mary be with you! It is dawn, and the cold is less!"
Eduardo woke at once, and with a clearer mind by far. He blessed God, gathered himself, writhed round the dead llama, pushed the loose-packed snow away, and called back,
"The pass is now swept quite clear, and there is Tupac coming down with 2 other men."
He pulled the poor beast away. Light came flooding in, and Stephen looked at his morbid leg.
"Eduardo, my dear,"
he said hesitantly, after a careful examination,
"I grieve to tell you that my leg is deeply frostbitten. If I am fortunate, I may lose no more than some toes. But even in that case, I cannot do more than creep. Pray pass me a handful of snow."
As he chafed the pallid leg and the ominously bluing foot with snow, Eduardo agreed.
"But," he said, "pray do not take it to heart. Many of us have lost toes on the Puna without great harm. And as for reaching Arica, why, never concern yourself at all. You shall have a Peruvian chair. I shall send on to the village, and you will travel like Pachacutic Inca himself, cross the bridge, the hills, and the valleys, in a Peruvian chair."